Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hi. Not Pennsylvania.
All right.
I have heard of you guys through Michael, and Michael and I used to talk back in 2017, and he invited me to the call tonight. So here I am.
Great. Well, I am Michael also, and your name?
My first name is John. Yeah, Cipolla.
Welcome, John. I know that person. Wonderful. Good to hear you, John.
Thank you.
Anyways, yeah, thank you. So, Martin, go ahead with your disclaimer, if you would, please.
All right. Very good. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. Since you're on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everybody in no uncertain terms that anybody looking for legal advice has no place or business here on any of these calls. Nobody here at Tremedy is in the law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just folks saying what they might do or they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of the deal. Get some experience from folks that, what they've been through. Storytelling, if you will. But that's about the extent of it. Again, if you require any kind of actual legal advice, you'd have to get an attorney. All right. If I can draw everybody's attention to the homepage of Your Remedy is in the Law, www.yourremediesinthelaw.com. We look up in the upper right-hand corner. We see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up. It's got two items on it, an otherwise blank page. Just two only items there. But these items are of much, much importance, especially if this is all new to you. On the left is the Juris Dictionary course, your 24-hour crash course on American jurisprudence, better known to some as AMJUR. What this is essentially is the foundation upon which all law in America rests, American jurisprudence is. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of it, to have diligently devoured this course multiple times, I would suggest. Once you've got that sewed up pretty tight now, that would mean that you would have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in really virtually any court scenario that you would find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process. Of course, some of you folks say the common law default process, that's for traffic tickets. Yes, that is what it's primarily known for. That's what most people require this course for. So it's a very, very high win rate, high win rate. But that's not why it's here. The reason that it's here is, again, especially if this is new to you, once you've gone through the jurisdictionary course and you start in on the common law default process, you'll see very quickly that it lines up. It mirrors almost perfectly. It acts as really as a real-life homework assignment. So you've gone through your jurisdictionary course. Now you're doing the common law default, and those basic pillars, that core of how this all works, you're now exercising it out through the common law default process. And then, of course, with the common law default process being primarily used for traffic court scenarios, and of course traffic court is such a common thing that we see in this country, we find it also helps folks that are new because traffic scenarios are thankfully usually more times than not, they're usually, lesser severity situations. And so, if things don't go exactly according to plan, it's usually not the end of the world. So folks feel a little bit braver, I guess I should say. And they're more happy to use that to get their feet wet. And now with a very generous asking of just a contribution of $250 for the jurisdictionary course and $150 for the common law default process, we strongly encourage you to close up at your absolute earliest convenience. All right. On to the next subject. If we look on the home page of Your Remedy is in the Law, of course, every time we go to Your Remedy is in the Law, that little flag pops up, a little box pops up and asks if we want to continue on where we were requesting to go, or would we mind stopping, taking a moment and checking out Americans Restoring America. We've done this really because we're wanting to get folks to explore. Your Remedy is in the Law is, of course, under the blanket of Americans Restoring America. We have many different information providers providing many different educational processes. And then all of that just being Your Remedy is in the Law. And then there are multiple sites, I want to say about like a dozen, that are all under Americans Restoring America. So there's a tremendous amount there to digest, a lot of many wonderful different educational tools and processes. And so, again, at your earliest convenience, we strongly encourage you to check out Americans Restoring America. Just kind of poke around, see if you see anything that piques your interest. Most folks do. So, if you haven't already as well, go ahead and pick up a membership to Your Remedies in the Law. Also, a very, very affordable contribution of $10 a month. There are so many extra goodies that you get there with that $10 membership. Primarily, the archives. The archives. Now, some of you folks may be familiar with Freedom's Radio. If you're not, something else for you to check out there, freedomsradio.com. Every single call that we have is broadcasted out over Freedom's Radio. By the way, if you find yourself in a situation where you don't want to dial into the call that night, maybe you're in a hurry, maybe you're traveling over, you're out of the road, just jump on Freedom's Radio and enjoy these calls. Now, of course, Freedom's Radio is no cost to you. So every single call, every night, you can enjoy those calls without any contributions. But that membership there that we were just speaking about, Your Remedies in the Law, contribution of $10 a month, one of the biggest things with that you're going to pick up is now the get to the archives for all the previous calls. So all the different information providers that we've had, all the different topics over all the years, just an untold vast wealth of knowledge there and experience. Lots and lots and lots of opinions to be heard, lots of two cents. You now have unlimited access to that with your $10 a month contribution for the Your Remedy membership. And so we encourage you to get on that, too, at your earliest convenience. All right. On to the next topic. Brassfire Communications, formerly known as Statewide Communications. Not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends, tell your family about it. What it is a private communications platform that enables you to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. By the way, that's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every page, every website that we have. How it works, essentially, is you've got a very user-friendly, very easy-to-navigate setup. You know, put your name in here, click next, put your address in here, click next. As you get to the end, it's going to ask you to pick from quite a healthy list of different topics. What are the ones that interest you? Pretty much no matter what the scenario is, we've got the topic, or we've got that that topic there in the list. Whether it's veterans' rights, credit cards, home foreclosures, IRS matters, on and on and on, you can find it in that list. And so then when it's all done, wraps it all up and gives it back to you, much like a lot of folks would say is, like it feels like a social media, but really nothing like a social media. It's very, very private, It was very, very secure. And so it's going to put you in contact with people right there in your local area that have the same interests that you do. And so if you're just hearing about this, you can imagine, you know, the impact that that could have. Not just with education, but, you know, with, you know, political matters as well. So there's no contribution required for that either. So we encourage you to sign up for that today. All right. Let's start winding down here. This next portion is called your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. When you come aboard with an information provider, you decide to do so, come aboard with an information provider here if your remedy is in the law, you're doing just that. Information providers pay your remedies in the law to advertise there on that site. That would be an expense to that information provider, along with any other expenses that that info provider has associated with your particular educational process. We always hope for the best. We plan for the best. But believe you me, we aim for the best. If you have any questions of that, I encourage you to check out yourremediesinthelaw.com/testimonials, and you'll see very quickly what we mean by that. But, you know, in life, sometimes things happen. And when they do, we have to roll with them and deal with them like we do with anything else in life. But that brings us to the topic of the refund policy at your remedy isn't long. There is none. Again, when you're coming aboard with an information provider, you're doing just that. You're going with that information provider. And so, for example, if there is to be any talk of a refund or a credit or anything like that, that would be a strict and private matter just between you and your information provider. But I can tell you, folks, that's few and far between. It has to be some pretty extenuating circumstances. Again, as always, you're expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to an information provider's time. All right. Well, one last thing here. These information providers, these speakers on our calls are our guests. And please, they should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that one of our speakers has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn. It's part of the process. But there's never a reason to not be friendly and courteous. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then it's answered properly, then we all get to learn something from it. All right, well, that's
your ramble for this evening, Martin. We thank you so very, very much. All right, tonight we're going to have a very interesting conversation with Brother John. The conversation is regarding affidavits. Just a 30,000-foot view real quickly. A notarized affidavit is a written statement that is sworn under oath. In other words, the one signing the affidavit swears under oath that the information is true and correct. Affidavits are commonly used in court cases as evidence to support one side or the other. So how does an affidavit or notarized affidavit work as evidence? Well, since the person providing the affidavit is sworn that the information is truthful, the court can now consider the affidavit or notarized affidavit as factual evidence. The affidavit may contain witness testimony, expert opinion, or other information that helps prove a key point. However, affidavits have limitations as well. So while affidavits can be useful to support arguments or help prove facts in a situation, witness testimony, that means somebody's taking the stand, is considered more compelling in the court. And the key is providing affidavits from credible witnesses that contain factual firsthand accounts of events rather than speculation or opinion. When used properly and for the right reasons, affidavits can be valuable evidence in a court. Just a key thing to remind you of, in the 2000 election, regarding the shards in Florida. Affidavits were presented to the courts in Tampa, the federal court, district court in Tampa. And the judge says, okay, I have the affidavits. Where are those that are going to testify? And all of those affidavits were thrown out because the court required the people to actually give the evidence. So this is going to be an interesting call tonight with Brother John. I want you to pay close attention because you're going to learn some valuable information. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to Brother John.
Well, thank you, Martin, and thank you, Michael, for your kind and gracious introductions. Affidavits take a lot of form, and as Michael said, that there are some pros and some cons. Affidavits can be used at a grand jury hearing to compel a grand jury indictment. However, there's a threshold, as Michael pointed out, where the affidavits can and can't be used. Under the Sixth Amendment, you have the right to cross-examine witnesses against you. If it comes to a trial or a court where there's a trial, say a trial by jury, and it goes to trial, whether it's a trial by judge or trial by jury, and the opposing party says, well, I would like to potentially gain more detail as to the evidence that you're presenting in your affidavit there, they have the right to cross-examine that witness. And to that end, if they're not able to produce the witness, just like the affidavits that were that he so carefully spoke of in Florida there, the judge threw most of those out. There were only three that he didn't throw out because the judge was very biased. And the only three that he didn't throw out were the ones where the individuals were actually there waiting. And they went along just to see, more out of curiosity, didn't realize that with the gravity of the situation that the judge was going to use the test of cross-examination to accept the initial affidavits and the complaints there, even though they at that juncture there had been no contention of cross-examination. Excuse me. The judge chose to exercise that gravity, and anyone that, where there was not somebody there that could not be cross-examined, he threw those out. Now, you know, in discussions about the election, for the first time after the election, many of you still remember this, that the first time that DT came, held a press conference, I don't know if any of you remember, but he was holding a white binder. And that white binder had 42 affidavits in it. And when he was talking about the difficulties that were inquiring that they were looking into regarding the election fraud, I don't know if you remember, but he held up that binder and even opened it and paged through at one point and mentioned a few highlights of some of the affidavits that were in there. One of those affidavits was from the state of Michigan, and it had 42 elected officials in wet ink, not a copy, but the wet ink original, that they had all signed the affidavit about the election fraud. And every one of them, 42 state elected officials, state senators, not U.S. senators, but state senators, state representatives, not U.S. representatives, and judiciary. And that As strange as it sounds, when it came to the Senate Oversight Hearing Committee on the fraud, they accepted that. And none of those individuals were there to testify. And when we went to the Georgia trial and to the Pennsylvania hearings and the Arizona hearings, there was a colonel that was there in all three of those hearings, and they were all carried on the news media, and much of the hearing proceedings are still there available. But Colonel Waldron, and then there was a young gentleman that had pattern male baldness. He's who we called our white hat. You all probably know what a black hat is. They hold a black hat convention in Las Vegas every year to see who can be the hacker's hacker. And back in 1993, challenge was to see who could hack Atlanta Ghostcom, and our white hat there made quietly got into every single person's transmissions and put up, look, I know who you are. This is what you just did. These are the laws you just broke. And he did not break a single law. His affidavits were accepted, were one of the only affidavits that were accepted by the, there was 19 of the ones out of DT's binder that were accepted, but his was one of the only ones that was accepted at the Arizona hearings, as well as the Philadelphia, the Pennsylvania hearings. And what happened was is that he carried some specific weight. He had unbelievable credentials. He was there. His affidavits, they didn't even call him to testify. I don't know if you watched the Arizona hearings, but when Colonel Waldron submitted his the White Hat's affidavit, and we don't use his name. He since has had to move. First house after the Arizona hearings that he had with his wife and children burned to the ground under suspicious circumstances. The second one, they were all out back when the house exploded. The third house, a tractor trailer, literally entered through what would have normally been considered the front door and left through the patio glass doors, taking out the main structure so that the second floor became the first floor, and two of his children were badly injured in that one. But sometimes you use affidavits to protect the innocent. There are some affidavits that have even been authored under a nom de plume or a nom de guerre, if you will, under a fictitious name, with the intent that if they have to appear, that they will appear and testify under their correct name. Two of the individuals that we were working with on the Dominion voting systems appeared that way when we provided the affidavits to the White House. They were very considerate for that, those individuals. There's an individual that was there when Dominion was implemented in Venezuela, and he his children grew up with Hugo Chavez's children, and he knew Hugo Chavez, and they were all personal good friends. And his affidavit was treated with nothing but the highest respect, and the Senate granted him a personal private appearance where they went to him to get his testimony. They videotaped his testimony, they provided him a new place to live, him and his children. The affidavit, still to this day, his affidavit, because there are three other people, three U.S. senators that were on the Senate Oversight Committee on election fraud there, that to this day, they've stood beside that affidavit on a nom de plume, a different name. And they know, everybody knows it, you know, and from time to time they produce the video. He responds in his alter name, but they still accept that affidavit. Affidavits, many of them that related to, and we're talking very high on the fruit tree here. We're relating to the election fraud. Many of these affidavits, as Michael said, were turned down by the judiciary. Of those 42 that were in that binder, only one of them to this date has been disqualified and is submitted in any of the hearings. And as strange as this sounds, he keeps that binder personally, or there's one. She was counsel for the White House, not counsel for him, counsel for the White House, that she is the only one that is allowed to handle that binder. And when it goes to the hearings, although it's submitted as testimony and evidence, it's under the stipulation that it never leaves her hands. And the judiciary has complained, well, we need this submitted into the record. Well, digital copies were provided. You may ask how I know that. Don't ask. The digital copies of all them were provided and have been provided to every judiciary and every prosecutor that has asked for it, and everyone in the House and the Senate that it has been bought up with. But those originals have never left her hands or his hands. And they even threatened to put her in jail, put her in prison, and she refused to. You don't take a 5 foot, 4.5, 91 hair, pound, blonde hair, blue eyed, White House, attorney and, you know, and get eight big tough guys and a sumo wrestler to go beat her up, in front of witnesses. That doesn't go over very well, you know, and he chose very, very carefully who he had interfacing there and who he had interfacing with the task force, the task group that that was reporting to him. But affidavits, backing down to just a little bit more lighter-hearted affidavit, you're driving down the street, and all of a sudden you see a dog run out in the road, and someone not only hits the dog or a deer, but ricochets the animal into another vehicle that causes that other vehicle to lose control. And that other vehicle has a semi-catastrophic accident. No fatalities, but three hospitalized with injuries. The fourth was released. This lady, 27 years old, immediately got a sheet of paper out, wrote down exactly what she had seen, exactly how it was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And at the scene, they were taking the car away and this and that and taking everything else. And she told the officer, look, I wrote down what I saw, you know, and he got a brief 40,000 foot, did not captionalize, you know, it correctly in his report, but completely ignored the fact that the animal had been already, the deer had been struck by another vehicle that appeared to be aiming for it. And he completely ignored that. Well, this lady, he says, no thanks, I'll, you know, pass on it. She put it in her purse. The next day at her office, there was a notary public there. She had it notarized, and she went and filed it, of all things, with the county clerk. And it was just unbelievable, you know, and didn't think much of it. 2 years later, the trial involving this, there's a trial going on, and she reads about it in the newspaper and calls, calls up one of the attorneys and says, look, go get this that's recorded under this information. They didn't even call her to testify to it. They completely overturned the charges that the lady that was driving that had the semi-catastrophic accident. The children, the parents of two of the children, two separate families, were suing this lady for potential reckless child. They were suing her for child endangerment, but she was charged with two counts of felony reckless child endangerment. And this affidavit that this lady, something happened, she saw it, she thought she should memorialize it, she did, she documented it, and then, of all things, who would have thought to, and back then, the county clerk would accept anything. Now, most county clerks, you have to have an IPN, you know, a parcel number, you know, et cetera, or something to, otherwise they won't accept it. But there were many years where there's many, many, many documents that I filed with the local county clerk here in Texas. There, that I memorialized things that happened and that I put them there for safekeeping. So if something happened to me, or if I had a fire in my place burned down, but that had never happened, not almost 9 years ago on Memorial Day, day before Memorial Day, my place burned down. And I had a couple of thousand affidavits that all went away. About 300 of them were recorded. Most of them would never need them again. But I'll tell you something, out of the ones that the affidavits of things that I saw or things that I heard, and I was in a restaurant one time when somebody's wife got sick, and the husband threatened to kill the cook. Went outside, I wrote everything down and memorialized it and had it notarized the next day when I was working at Continental Airlines. This is back in the early 90s. Well, turns out that cook turned up dead. Now, I turned in the affidavit, and they went and detained the guy that did it. Turns out he wasn't the one who did it. You know, it would have been kind of nice to say, yeah, I memorialized something, and they caught a killer because of it. Well, turns out that detective said that there was something else that in the affidavit that led them to the correct party. But it was kind of made me feel good that there was something that contributed to it. But when you make an affidavit, we had to go in for a hearing, my wife and I, a couple of years ago. And before we did that, we both made an affidavit that two of the circumstances regarding our property and its usage. And we had it recorded at the county clerk's office, and that's under the parcel number, the APN, the assessor's parcel number. And we went to the hearing, and oh, gosh, golly gee willikers, they had hearsay, and they were trying to take our property away from us, and because of fraud. And finally, after the county got done with their presentation, the judge looked at it and says, "Do you have anything to say for yourself?" I says, "Well, here's an affidavit that that speaks contrary to the information. It shares facts and evidence contrary to the information you got." And he barely looked at it and says, "Well, this was done by you. I'm not accepting it, you know." And they ruled against us. And this was in a quote unquote tribunal. There were three judges there, and in Texas, when you volunteer for certain duties like that, you're immune from prosecution. Except that what happened was is that in this case, he was violating the Texas the rules of civil procedure in Texas here, and the rule regarding discovery and evidence is very, very explicit and clear, and he was accepting hearsay in opposite to testimony and evidence that were facts in evidence and the record, and that was our affidavit. And we filed against, and this was regarding a property tax issue, and we filed against the taxing authority. And we got into court, and I don't know why, but the judge let them speak first, and the judge was about to rule in their favor, and I raised my hand, and he says, "Well, what do you have to say? This is an open and shut case." I says, "Your Honor, the tribunal, the board, was accepting hearsay in opposite to testimony and and facts that were already in evidence." He says, and he says, "How can that be?" I says, "The affidavit." And he used the word holy shaving cream, Batman. Holy shaving cream. He says, "Did you guys look at this?" He says, "Yeah, I saw that. It's just that they're the ones that's." He says, "No, it's recorded at the county clerk's office under the APN." And he said, "This is testimony and evidence." He says, "Your investigator, your people, your clerk, all have committed perjury." And he said, "They can't." He says, "And that also means that the three of you have violated the rules of civil procedure, and therefore that's a criminal act, and therefore your civil protection is gone." Now he says, I'm gonna suggest that you meet with the plaintiffs in this case and sort this out." And it was about 11 o'clock. He says, "We're gonna re-adjourn at 1:00. And he says, "We're going to recess till 1:00. And then if you haven't figured it out and sorted it out, I'm going to sort it out." And he says, "You're not going to like where I'm going." And they were All six of the individuals involved all came to the witness room, and they had food bought in. They wined and dined us. It was just unbelievable. I say wined and dined. I got a dry hamburger, but the thing was is that with the ascent, everything was corrected. And, it turns out that having that testimony and evidence already on the record made a difference. And that was after we had been completely run over once and almost run over a second time. There's now been multiple cases dealing with the county and the city, called a violation, and they say you're in violation of this code or that code, and we've filed affidavits, and when it comes to the hearing, the affidavits, we regularly have to remind them that, Your Honor, this is facts and testimony and evidence that's already entered into the record, and we're resubmitting for your consideration. And one of them had to do with floodplain restrictions and et cetera. And another one had to do with an ex post facto law that 26 years after something was modified and done on our property. Well, it had been that way since we purchased it, and it was done before we purchased it, that they were trying to prosecute us for. That testimony and evidence that was entered in the form of an affidavit is what stood and made the difference. There are cases where there was a divorce case in San Diego, California, that the wife chose to remain silent and not have things. She was hoping and praying that her husband would change and things would correct, and he didn't. But she was quietly documenting and making affidavits at our recommendation, and putting them in the safe deposit box. And it wasn't her safe deposit box. It was someone else's. In the event that something happened to her, you know, this other person, he was supposed to bring this all to light. Well, something did happen to her, but it wasn't fatal. Her husband complained that it was something that had just occurred, and they, there had been no history or anything else. Well, she bought out, this other gentleman bought out 6 years, over 30 affidavits, over a 6-year period of history, and he was actually statute of limitations on 11 of those events had not run out. And the prosecutor, the county prosecutor in San Diego, charged him with 11 felony counts of assault and battery based on the affidavits that she had authored, and that there were times where she had others author affidavits, including two doctors that she put with the these over 30 events. Excuse me, please. Forgive me. But what happened was that the gentleman was charged with 11 counts and convicted of 8. He is still serving time in Chino Men's Institution in Southern California. The affidavits are testimony and evidence that's, that you that you can enter into the record or may already be, you may have already entered into the record. There was some, the gentleman who had a parcel in Idaho, in Salmon River, Idaho, he had individuals that made him offers on his parcel that he would not that they would not pay him what he was asking for it. They said there was this problem with it, there was that problem with it, and he graciously asked them if they could write that down, and you know they. So what happened was, is when the assessor collector went to inject him the taxes from a parcel that was vacant. It was 7.5 acres, to my recollection, and they went from $30,000 to over $900,000 because it was a corner lot in Salmon River, Idaho. And he refused to pay the taxes on it. They did a tax foreclosure, and it happened very quickly. Within 90 days, they served him with a tax bill. He did not pay it before the deadline. They foreclosed. They did a tax sale, and they were selling the property, and actually sold the property. And he was still appealing the taxes with the property tax board, and they had already sold his property. And what happened was is that he had 9 of these affidavits that said because there was this wrong or that wrong, and he complained to the appraisal district that their appraisal was flawed because of this problem and that problem, and they said horse feathers, you know. And at the first hearing, he did not bring all those affidavits. That first hearing was 2 days before the auction sale. Then what happened was that he filed a motion for temporary injunction and permanent restraining order against the appraisal district and the local county to sell it. And it took them 14 days for the hearing for the temporary injunction, at which time the property was sold. And it not only was sold to somebody at the courthouse steps, but that person flipped it to a second party in less than 10 days. And they did what was called a dual closing. So that by the time the injunction was there, he no longer owned the property. The person that purchased it at the auction, at the sheriff's auction, no longer owned it, but a third party owned it and was in the process of trying to sell it. And the reason they were trying to sell it was there was problems with it. And one of them was the fact that the stream in the back of the property regularly overflowed into the property and flooded it. But because the foliage and the grass was so deep, you couldn't see that from the street. The curb appeal, and because it was heavily wooded, the curb appeal was good, but the underlying defect, meaning that it flooded and couldn't be built on, because the there's something called liquefaction, and that's when you get enough moisture in the soil that the soil becomes like quicksand. And this gentleman, they charged him with multiple bills, tax bills that were not alleviated. They would not let the sale of the property alleviate it. They refused to, even though that's illegal. But everybody that bought the property that all of a sudden walked it didn't want it. And there were places where there was actually quicksand. It was, well, not quicksand. It was quick mud. But the soil would never stabilize. You know, most river bottoms and stuff, you know, you can walk in the, you know, the knee-deep water and or ankle-deep water, and there's no problem. Not this piece of property. There were serious challenges with it. But when he went to the state district court, the affidavits from the others that had tried to purchase the property were all the judge looked at, and he the tax district, they were, he was given $1.2 million worth of damages, and they were forced to buy back the property and return it to him. And when I asked him why he put up with that, you know, he should have just, you know, got, he says he didn't. The judge, nobody wanted anything to do with that piece of property, and he ended up getting the property back almost as a gift. Because of the difficulty with the stream. But the thing that solved his issues that and got him a judgment that was far more than, you know, than he could have ever hoped for, $1.2 million from the local, from the appraisal district, from the local county government. That was all about the affidavits. The affidavits were testimony and evidence when they that was entered into the record that to the judge that was as if E.F. Hutton was standing there talking to him and explained everything. In one of the affidavits, the female buyer included half a dozen photographs, and in one of the photographs there was a three photograph clip where they showed a child's toy, a little plastic fire engine type child's toy, ride along thing, metal thing. They went and set it in the mud, and they took three photos as this thing began to sink into the mud, and all about 5 or 6 minutes apart. And that but the thing that about your affidavits are is that when you file a case, remember last week we talked about what the preparation and perspiration that you might go through to file a case in U.S. District Court. One of the things is that when you rule 12B6 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure is that you must state a claim for with which relief can be granted. When you complain, you have to state that what you're complaining, and you have to state the facts. And to support the facts, you always, always, always author an affidavit, and you put your testimony and evidence regarding your facts into that. Now, you being the plaintiff, all of those, you know, your affidavit's going to be accepted on the condition that you'll be there to testify in support of it. But what that does is if you have to ask for a temporary injunction without the other party there, if the other party does not show up, what happens is that the affidavits that you give will be accepted, and the other party will default and get a judgment against them, meaning an injunction or a restraining order against them. Because you had submitted testimony and evidence into the record, okay? You have facts and evidence. So when you file even just a civil case, you know, if you're going to go to small claims court, you have a car accident, you've got a sideswipe. What happens is that the affidavits that you would author is that, hey, I was proceeding northbound on Main Street, and this person pulled up behind me, was flashing their lights. I pulled over, and they took off down the road and then pulled into change lanes in front of me and then slammed on the brakes, you know, precipitating me standing on the brakes, and I missed them, you know, I just missed them, and passed them on the left lane, and then they sped up and then pulled in the left lane and slammed on the brakes, and I hit them, you know, and precipitating an event after I passed them when they were standing still. That, when the other part complains to the police officer that you hit them and that you maybe did a lane change that precipitated the accident, and they're out hunting for insurance money. Well, when you did that, you submitted testimony and evidence into the record that they don't have something to stand against that. At this juncture, what happens is that when you have the potential threat of litigation, or my little brother, precious, honorable young man, many years younger than I myself. I have four brothers, and he is the, I'm number one, I'm the oldest, and he's number four. When my parents' health began to fail, my wife and I and my son did a videotape and an affidavit that many years, 12 years before my mother passed away, and it'd be 14 and a half before my father would pass away. We did a videotape and an affidavit that we, because of his kindness to my parents, because he moved in with my parents did not want to leave the house that they had lived in most of their married life, that they had lived in that house for over 50 years, that when they left that house, it wanted to be feet first. And one of my brothers, number four, he stood up for their consideration, and he and his wife and two children played nurse and caregiver, etc. They were reduced to abject caregivers, literally. Both parents, one after the other, depreciated health-wise to the point where they had to be waited on hand and foot. They did not put them in a care facility. They were very honest, precious, honorable. My wife and my son and I, we made a videotape saying, look, if there's any inheritance that due us from the family estate or the house, we would like that to go to this brother and his wife for the kindness that they've shown our parents. And they had already been living there for 4 years. And because my parents' health was depreciating a little bit, that house, when it was built, never had central heating and air. And so I went and personally installed it. I stayed in California. I actually, from many years earlier, I had a master's license in HVAC. And I went and put in the nicest air conditioning central heat that you could possibly put into a house like that. My little brother was there hand and foot waiting on me, helping everything. John Arthur was there working on it too, but he was there hand and foot. Anything we did to that house, I'd fly out there and work on it. And we made an affidavit that to the effect that we had made a video. I made an affidavit that, you know, anything that I had was Corbin unto my brother, given unto him for his kindness. Now, I had already been through some bloody battles over inheritance and et cetera, et cetera. And the only person that, the only people that win are the attorneys. Well, my brothers and sisters, two of my sisters and one of my brothers went to litigious fisticuffs over their slice of the pie, the inheritance, et cetera, et cetera. And when they saw the affidavits that we had authored and asked why we weren't fighting for ours, it set an example, and the blood spatter went away. This evening, we've touched a little bit on different circumstances for affidavits that range from at home with your loved ones and your beloved, all the way up to, you know, maybe what consider would be the government of this nation. You might ask myself how I know about the 42 affidavits that were in that binder. You may know personally the person who put 28 of them in there, and that one from Michigan, you may know personally the person that got that affidavit with the 42 wet signed signatures and supplied it to the White House counsel to have put in that binder. When I say we've just scratched the tip of the iceberg, yeah. Usually when we start a topic like this, I try to at least give a 40,000-foot view. There's so much more power in the affidavits. We're giving you a little teeny-weeny bit. I've actually exceeded my time to this evening, and we're going to turn it over to question and answer. If you have questions and you're able to refrain to the subject matter topic, that would be a blessing. And if you have questions related any to any other topic, you're free to ask them. Thank you. Back to you, Martin, and back to you, Michael.
Well, thank you very much, Brother John. That was a very, very good monologue that you shared with us tonight. Thank you so much. I just want to give you a heads up that we have tonight with us Johnny Ringo. So you might want to know that. And press star two on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star two. For those of you on Freedom's Radio, you'll see to the center right of your monitor the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty. Left-click inside of that rectangle, and then type away your comment or question. Outside that rectangle, underneath, is a place to put your name and some other information. Once that's done, then just hit submit, and then I will be happy to lend my voice for your comment or question. So we start off with Bill out of Tennessee. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, John, thank you for the presentation tonight. It was very, very interesting. When you record an affidavit in court, with the clerk of the court, for something that's just out of the blue that you witnessed, of course you have no case number under which to file it. So how do you present it to the clerk of the court?
Ah, that's a very good question. Now, first of all, when I have an affidavit that potentially may come up in litigation or criminal prosecution, I always author 5 copies, okay? Now, when I said recording with the clerk, if there is already a case number, obviously you record it with that. But, however, here's the little secret handshake. The county clerk's office, the recorder of deeds, if the event occurred on this property or that property, finding the APN for that, where the diner is, where the fight broke out, get the APN and say, and what you do is you have it recorded under that assessor's parcel number of the diner under ancillary supporting data, and you go file it with the recorder of deeds. There's a lot of creative ways to do that, Bill.
Okay. And if it doesn't have to do with property, if you witness something, it doesn't have to do with property, how do you get it recorded?
Well, now, there's traffic accidents that I've witnessed, and what I did was years ago, they used to allow you to record anything at the county clerk's office. The workload was such that too many people were starting to get wind of the ease and the way that you could have those things recorded. And to reduce that, like the state of California now only at the county clerk's office where you record the deeds, they require an assessor's parcel number. There are certain times where you will not be able to find a way to put it into public record ahead of time. That's when you put it into private safe deposit box. And, as I mentioned, Sally, actually I shouldn't use her name. She had a friend record or have put it in her safe deposit box. And actually her husband was the one that was looking over, taking care of it for them. But there are times where you will not be able to get it recorded. So have it put in a safe deposit box, and you keep. Now, if you're following the policy that I like, the policy of five, always, always, always sign five copies of it and have five copies notarized so that there's an original in the safe deposit box. Maybe you have your own safe deposit box and have original, but there's another party that has an original or two in their safe deposit box. And one nice thing about that is if somebody breaks into your safe deposit box, they think they got the only original. Does that help at all?
Well, when that's brought up or presented to the court later on, how do they accept it without your testimony?
Okay, now remember what we talked about at the beginning. Wasn't there something about the Sixth Amendment and the right to cross examine your accuser?
Right.
Remember that?
Yep.
Okay. However it slices out, when you give that affidavit to the prosecutor or the attorney for the plaintiff in a case where there was a car accident, they're going to get to the place where that will get them into court. That affidavit will get them to the place where they are actually approved. They get a case number. They'll have a trial. But when it comes down to the facts, if the other party wants to question the facts that are in that affidavit, you must be accessible and presentable for them
sure.
to cross-examine.
Okay. Makes sense.
Any other questions, my honored brother?
No, I think that'll do it. I appreciate it.
How's the weather in Tennessee tonight?
I'm back down in Florida right now, and it's nice.
Okay.
70s, high 70s this afternoon.
Oh boy. Well, I'll look forward to some of that Florida weather myself someday.
Okay. Come down
okay.
and visit.
Thank you. Back to you, Martin, and back to you, Michael.
All right. Our next speaker raised hand is from Daniel in California. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yes. Thank you, Mike. It was a very interesting. I enjoyed your thing. I wanted basically to say to Michael, I need for you to call me after the call. I'm in the hospital, so I'm in and out. If you don't get me, call me back, please.
Okay. All right, I'll do that. Let me just verify. Hold on a second. So we're going to be using 2292?
Yes.
All right. I'll take care
All
of
right.
that.
All right. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure. All right. Anyone else? Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Otherwise, we're going to be saying nighty-night extra early. Let me go check.
By the way,
go ahead.
By the way, I want to thank all of you for your patience and your graciousness the last couple of weeks. I've been fighting a little bit of a bug. Actually, it was downright nasty, and today has actually been my first day out of bed and out of the house without. So I just want to say thank you, and also. I wanted to say thank you for Elvis being in the house. I mean, Johnny Ringo being in the house.
Well, Johnny has raised his hand, so after we finish with Charlie here, it will be Johnny Ringo. Go ahead, Charlie.
Yeah, let's see. Am I unmuted here? Yes, I am.
No,
okay.
We can't hear you.
No, we can't hear you.
Okay. This probably goes without. Anyway, just to ask. A affidavit. That is not notarized, I presume, is of no
It's not
benefit.
An affidavit.
Got it. Okay.
It's not an affidavit, but it can be a statement of facts, and especially if you have two witnesses to sign it. Maybe you can't find a notary, okay? But the fact that there are two witnesses, and you say, this is my name, you know, this is my contact information, this is my passport card number. I have never seen anything with two witnesses turned down yet in court adversely to an affidavit, but it is not an affidavit.
Well, golly okay. gee, Brother John, would you like to tell us where that came from?
The two witnesses, for those of you who believe in an intelligent designer of this third rock from the sun that we call planet Earth and home, there may be a history of two witnesses in the Judeo-Christian Hebraic reckoning of history. And it used to be that deaths, births, marriages, they were all recorded in one place for many, many years, for a couple of hundred years. After Gutenberg got good at the printing press there, other people got good at the printing press, and they started putting in the front and or sometimes in the back of the Bible. They would places where you could enter births and deaths and marriages and weddings. And along with those were always, there was always notes for two witnesses. And I've been working with families and people for over 40 years, having children without a birth certificate. The etymology of a birth certificate was that property from that was from the joint union of two individuals from two separate property owners, i.e. slaves like on plantations, was property of the state. And so they had to document it. And so what happened was that with the documentation of that, that was the birth certificate. And it was required when there was a license to get married, meaning that you couldn't get married without that license. And however, those that didn't require a license to be married, that weren't slaves, that were just regular free-born individuals, they used to record their weddings in the family Bible. Midwives, I work with a handful of midwives over the years, and I still, from time to time, participate. I participated in a online training thing for midwives just a little while back, and we explained to them about their signature and one other witness's signature to the birth, taking pictures of the child, get a footprint, put it in two periodicals, two newspapers. On this day, the daughter of such and such married to the son of such and such and such and such bore a female or a male child weighing this much, named the following name, was born on this date at this time in this geographical locale of as a an individual in the state of this particular state. And I just spent a large portion of November helping a handful of individuals get passports without Social Security numbers and without birth certificates or any of that. And we there's one of those cases in the Tyler Canton area of Texas came up 22 years ago where children were seized by CPS, two families each having seven children, had a total of 12 of their 14 children seized by CPS, kidnapped, and because a nine-year-old was driving a pickup truck that had a shotgun rack in it that had a 22 and a 12-gauge shotgun, neither of them loaded. The sheriff, the county sheriff, drove through the barbed wire fence onto the private farm property, ran the children into a ditch, arrested them, took the shotgun and the rifle, and went to the farmhouse where 10 more of the children were doing homeschool, and seized them all. In court, we were able to prove that CPS did not have jurisdiction because they did not have a birth certificate, and the parents did not have a marriage license. The CPS attorneys and the attorney for the state complained that bitterly to the judge that, I'm sorry, a seven-year-old and a nine-year-old in possession of a firearm, that's, and we've charged the parents with criminal child. And I raised my hand and I says, Your Honor, where in the Constitution does it exclude those children from keeping and bearing a firearm on that that farm, let alone your courtroom? And this female CPS attorney blew up and says, there are nine-year-old and seven-year-old. And I says, I want to introduce you to somebody. This is a federal marshal. She says, I don't give a shaving cream. And I says, Your Honor, where in the Constitution does it say those inalienable rights are alienated until they reach the age of 18 or 21, like the prosecutors, you know? And the federal marshal made it very clear at the time. We had a John Wayne there, somebody that didn't care what his boss would say. He would arrest his boss if his boss was coloring outside the lines. And he started to hook up the prosecutor, and she repented, and they even got the rifle and the shotgun back and got the children all back within about 5 or 6 hours, and all the charges dropped. But the witnesses, the two witnesses, very, very important. All of their documentation, we had to produce that in court. We had a notebook binder for every child, and had the pictures of the children. You know, had the original footprint in there to show the and the midwives. They also most of them. I try to help them get their passport and their passport cards for all the midwives that work with, you know, these people, these homeschool families. And so they put their passport card number down there so that it identifies who they are. Has that been a little bit helpful?
A little bit. Just on the side, two points of information. One is that prior to a birth certificate being generated, a live birth announcement is generated, and that is the footprint and the feet, you know, handprints, et cetera, that are generated at the hospital, and then follows the birth certificate, which is actually delivered from the vital statistics of the state that you are sojourning at that time. The second thing was, just on the side, John, I was on my 7th birthday. I received from my daddy as a gift from Sears and Roebuck a .22 rifle, bolt-action rifle, single-round bolt-action rifle. And it was ordered from a Sears and Roebuck catalog, and it came in the mail through the post office, and no questions asked. It was an easy thing to do. Just wanted to share that with you. That was 1950.
When I was 8 years old, my father ordered a 10-shot Bernardelli pistol from the Sears Roebuck catalog for my birthday, and it came to me, not to my father. And the postman knew what was in the package. You know, Sears Roebuck wasn't bashful about, you know, the way they shipped things back then. But, but when I was 8, it came to me.
There you go.
I don't have a clue what you're talking about.
All right. And then just lastly, in support of what you had been saying, Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 6, and Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 15, state that the facts of the case must be established by the testimony of 2 or 3 witnesses for a criminal conviction, and that it is required for every charge and accusing statement to be sustained and confirmed in that way. Just wanted to let you know.
Thank you.
That you didn't know already.
Yeah. There's actually a few more references we could bring up. We could exhaust our evening and our time covering them, but we've gotten enough that now everybody understands. And with that, I guess back to you, Michael, or is Johnny Ringo's time?
Yes, it is. I've just unmuted Mr. Ringo, and he's ready to go.
Yeah, John, you mentioned a federal form. I believe it was B-12-6 to ask for compensation. Was that the correct number?
Okay, ask that question again a different way, Johnny.
You stated a form number, a federal form number to ask for compensation when you file a case. Was that B-12-6?
Excuse me. The 12B-6 is the That is the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. That is the that's the federal statute that specifically states that, you know, you must state a claim for which relief can be granted.
Oh yeah, that's what I thought it was. I must have misunderstood you.
Oh, so my humble apologies. Sometimes my communication skills aren't what they could be.
Oh, okay, thanks.
Yeah. All righty. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Johnny. And Johnny, once again, you're always welcome. We really appreciate you. Thank you.
Okay, well, appreciate it.
We're going to
take care.
For those of you on the call that like the hopium and whatnot from the reevaluation that we're anticipating shortly, there were when this happens, Johnny Ringel will be joining our team, and we're very excited about that. So while we're here, I'm just going to give you a couple things right here that I think you'll find very, very interesting. If I may, somewhere here. Da-da-da-da. Maybe not here. Let's go there. All right. Now, over the weekend, this is today's date. Over the weekend, this is where the fun gets. There's a lot of conversation and many stories about needing to have a committee for repricing. This is in Iraq. So why do they need to reprice anything? Maybe that they were getting ready to change the value of something? This is huge. And they were very upfront over this weekend of removing the zeros, and that they called the mechanism to delete the zeros. So that came out. And then another one is that the Central Bank of Iraq made an official RV announcement on TV. Iraq will present a sovereign coin and release it. So those were those good things that came up. And I just this moment got a text, bank story. Frank talks to a lady in Salt Lake City, Utah. She banks with a key bank. The teller has known nothing about the currency exchanges. Yesterday, the teller told her bank personnel had just completed training on the exchanging of the Iraqi dinar. So, Johnny, you start putting your bags together. We're going to get you down here to Florida.
Florida. Another thing you guys got to watch is this bank cryptocurrency. It's another thing that should be brought to attention because it could cripple this entire country. But, we'll be watching those Iraqi deniers or dinars, however you pronounce them. And as soon as it comes through, we'll come down and buy half of Florida.
There you go. Actually, I'm more interested in your testimony and your library.
Well, on my demise, you can have all of them because it won't make much difference anyway.
Well, I have a different perspective on that. So we'll just agree to disagree politely amongst gentlemen. Anything else in the drawing and closing?
You take care.
Thank you, sir. Anything else, Brother John, in closing?
Nope. Once again, it's truly an honor and a privilege to serve beside all of you in restoring liberty. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. And sometimes it's not just the blood, but sometimes it's the sweat, you know, and we, to stand up for liberty, we have to be willing to stand up for what we believe. And that old saying about he who stands for anything stands for nothing, and he who stands for nothing will stand for anything. Let's make sure that we stand up for what we believe and what's right. And with that, The Father's blessings be upon you all, upon you, your lives, your wives, and your husbands, and your children. Back to you, Michael.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. All right, everyone, consider joining us tomorrow night. I will be presenting for Mr. Slevin, and we'll be sharing with you how awesome his particular limited liability company is, even in the face of this ruling that took effect January 1st. Guess what? You can be exempt, and we'll show you how. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you.